controversy over the Jacksonville Children's Commission just ahead. What's the fate of programs for at-risk kids in Duval? We'll take a closer look. Good Thursday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime. You can stream us live on Facebook right now, too. Just ahead, is the mayor politicizing programs for kids? Some critics say he is. A closer look at the future of the Jacksonville Children's Commission at 549-2937. That's the number to give us a call. Then later, a beach in Jacksonville that catered to African Americans, now lost to history. We'll hear the story of Manhattan Beach and how you can be part of a special event. Plus, an easy way to win $1,000 all through the Jacksonville Historical Society. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, a new audit is out, and it shows that despite some criticisms in recent years, the Jacksonville Children's Commission, for the most part, is fulfilling its mission and doing pretty well in serving at-risk kids in the city. Which begs the question, why does Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry want to overhaul the city agency and merge it with the anti-crime program, the Jack's Journey? Critics say Curry is politicizing services for at-risk kids with this move. That's something the mayor denies. What's this all about? This morning, we've got a closer look as we welcome Tessa Duvall of the Florida Times Union. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Here's our question to callers. What do you think the future should be for programs in Jacksonville for at-risk kids? Let us know your thoughts. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page. So the mayor called for an audit of the Children's Commission in December, saying that it needed to be aligned with his priorities on public safety and opportunities for kids. The audit has been released. What did it show?
Well, it's a really substantial document that looks at all of the programs supported by the Jacksonville Children's Commission. Of course, the largest chunk of funding goes for out-of-school time, which is summer camp and after school. And what the audit showed is that for the kids who go and consistently go, they actually have better outcomes. You know, they're seeing improvement in these kids. And so that's kind of what's been at the controversy, right? That's sort of been the thing that the mayor has outwardly been unhappy with, is the amount of kids who are getting these services.
Was he saying there weren't enough kids getting served?
You know, a lot of his criticism was that it was not being aligned with his public safety goals. But part of that was, you know, there was a decision made earlier this year that the Jacksonville Children's Commission and the Jack's Journey would both pay more per seat in an effort to improve quality. But when they did that, it was with the same amount of money. So yes, fewer kids were going to be served. And that was something that when City Council got wind of it, we saw, you know, a press conference in June announcing more funding for summer camp, and the mayor made an announcement several weeks ago about more money for after school. So yes, people were unhappy that fewer kids would have been served with this new effort.
And so Mayor Curry is saying, let's put everything together and create a whole new organization, a blending of the Jacksonville Children's Commission and the Jacksonville Journey.
Right. So there is a proposal to merge these two organizations together. Right now, they are separate. You know, some money that goes to the Jack's Journey passes through the Children's Commission, but the Jack's Journey board makes decisions regarding how that money is spent. So there is a little bit of entanglement between the two, and they do overlap in the sense that they both provide services for children with summer camp after school. The Jack's Journey does some juvenile justice things. But it's important to know they were founded at different times in Jacksonville's history with different purposes. I mean, the Jack's Journey came about 10 years ago, I believe, as a crime prevention initiative. You know, it has programs that also work with adults. The Jacksonville Children's Commission came about in the early 90s as a way to depoliticize the way that children's programming was funded. You know, Mayor Ed Austin felt really strongly about this. You know, there was an effort to pass a tax to support the Children's Commission, much the way that, like, Miami, for example, has a tax for children's programs. That didn't pass, but the mayor still felt very passionately about that, hence why he created the Children's Commission once he took office.
What are your thoughts about how Jacksonville should handle programs for at-risk kids? Give us a call, 549-2937. So going all the way back then to Mayor Ed Austin, he said we need to depoliticize this children's service initiative. Critics of the current Mayor Curry say he is trying to politicize how this is handled. And to be clear, former Jacksonville Mayor Alvin Brown also tried to get his hands on this independent agency and do something different with it. So what's really going on here?
Right. So back when the Children's Commission was founded, you know, to hear people who are around for that fight talk about it, basically, if you had really good friends or powerful friends on city council, or you knew someone, that's how you were able to get your program funded. There was no grand plan. There was no real strategy in how children's programming was funded. That's why the Children's Commission came into existence. So any dollars for children from the city could pass through that organization.
To level the playing field for all kids.
Exactly. And so in 2011, Mayor Brown did try to pull it within his administration, and people really fought him tooth and nail on that, saying that you've got to keep politics out of this. This is about kids. So now that we've had a chance to see Mayor Curry's proposal, some people are kind of chiming back in. I believe my colleague Ron Little Page had some things to say about this, but there are some important notes about what is in the mayor's proposal. So, for example, one thing that I think really irritates a lot of people that I've talked to is you don't even have to live in Duval County. All you need is a substantial business interest. Mm-hmm. So that opens that up to a lot of people. I mean, Ponte Vedra, like who, you know, let's think about kind of who might live in Ponte Vedra that perhaps would have an interest in this, you know? So that is something that, you know, people are not a fan of. Additionally, the mayor would get to select the chair, which is also something that, again, people are not fond of. And finally, one of the changes is there would be actually fewer board members than the Children's Commission has now. There would be 7. And the way board members currently go onto the board is sort of like city council. So you have some with their own districts, their own zone, but that's like, that's the school board zones. And then you also have some who are at large. So if you have 7 people, but they don't have to represent a particular area, you know, a board member yesterday speaking out about this made the point that this could leave entire communities without representation if you don't have to be from a certain part of town.
And yes, you mentioned Ron Littlepage drawing criticism to this. We'll take some calls in a moment at 549-2937. What about supporters of the mayor's proposal, though? What are they saying?
Well, a lot of people see the Jacksonville Children's Commission and the Jack's Journey as having redundancies. And so for his supporters, and it's worth noting that 14 city council members stood next to him when he made this announcement. You know, they believe that this is a way to streamline the process, that if you can put all the money in one pot and have, you know, one group of people, these experts making the decision, that that's only going to lead to better outcomes for kids.
Okay. And let's go to some calls on this. As we look at the future of the Jacksonville Children's Commission, is the mayor doing a power grab? That's what his predecessor, Alvin Brown, was also accused of when he tried to do almost the same thing. 549-2937. Robert in Dinsmore. Hey, Robert. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I'm listening to your current conversation, and I agree with the young lady who is currently speaking. However, I have an alteration. I don't think that one entity should be able to control as much as they do. Because if we look, a lot of times, and most times, even currently, the kids are the ones who are suffering for the inability for the funds to be distributed correctly. I think when it comes to councils and 501c3s and you know, the nonprofits and you know, you have to have a chairperson, and I think a lot of that is rigged. You get people that you feel is going to do what you need for them to do within that organization. You know what I'm saying?
Thanks, Robert. Thanks for the call. 549-2937. Karen in Atlantic Beach. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. So It was widely known amongst those of us who worked in child-serving agencies that the last head of the Children's Commission very much played favorites when it came to giving out grants to different agencies. How do you create a system that isn't politicized?
That's a good question, and that's a tough question. How do you do that? That was the whole idea of this JCC initially.
Yeah. So that is, I mean, that's a challenge, right? Because even though the JCC is a supposedly an independent authority, I guess I would probably say quasi-independent, because ultimately there are still politics involved, right? I mean, there's a lot of politics that have been going on surrounding the Children's Commission since the mayor announced that he wanted an audit in December. I mean, that is kind of the reality, is that politics is a huge part of this, where, you know, the first caller mentioned, you know, this is about the children, and it really should be, but we aren't, you know, we're not talking about children right now. We're talking about the politics of the thing, because that there's a lot of money involved.
Does City Hall think, oh, if we can get control of this and create a new, they want to call it the Kids Hope Alliance, mm-hmm. that they can get better results? Because let's face it, the results aren't good in Duval County. As you know, Tessa, violent crime, poverty, poor educational outcomes. At-risk children just face this battery of barriers to success.
Yeah.
And so is the thinking from this administration, look, we've got to do something different. Even if the audit showed some good results, we have to take more drastic steps?
You know, I think that might be the train of thought that they're coming from, right? I mean, public safety is a big focus for the mayor. And of course, prevention is a huge part of public safety. So if you can keep kids safe off the street, I mean, I don't think it can be said enough that there are parts of town where children don't feel safe going outside and going to a park to play. So if there's a place for them to go where they will be safe, then that is definitely part of a public safety outcome. One thing that the audit did find that the Children's Commission needs to do a better job at is tracking data, tracking outcomes. So for some programs, there wasn't really a way to kind of quantify the outcome, if you will. And so that is one of the overarching recommendations when you read through this audit, is that, you know, if we're going to spend money on things, we have to know how it's performing.
Mm-hmm. So this legislation is likely to pass. If this new entity is created, what will it look like? And what will its overall purpose and vision be? And how will it be different than what we have now, do you think?
Well, I think a lot of that still has to be ironed out. As we were talking about earlier, there will be fewer board members. They may not even have to live in Jacksonville, but it's going to be working with the same pot of money. It's still going to be $36 million, which is currently the combined budget of the Children's Commission and the Jack's Journey. I can imagine that it'll still do many of the same things, including summer camp and after school. There are some questions about things like, where will mental health fit into the picture? For example, the Children's Commission is currently a funder of a program that puts therapists directly into 12 schools. And it's going into its third year now, but in its first 2 years, it's shown really promising results. You have more kids who, by the way, are living in communities where they're getting PTSD from the things that they're growing up around. So these kids are getting into treatment and getting help because the therapist is right there in the school. But mental health was not something that the mayor named as one of his focuses. So we'll have to see, does something like that, that still serves children and has proven to help children so far in these first 2 years, does that make the cut? And we don't know yet.
We'll have to follow it. In the meantime, great reporting as always. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
She's Tessa Duval of the Florida Times Union. Much more still ahead later. Author Ron Whittington, the latest in his Parker Glynn thriller series. But up next, a look back at the fascinating history of Manhattan Beach. Back in a moment.
Goodwill of North Florida. Donate, shop, jobs. Good things for North Florida with Goodwill. Proud supporters of WJCT's First Coast Connect. GoodwillJax.org for more info.
America is doing some heavy soul searching after the violence in Charlottesville and after President Trump's responses to it. The nation has survived far worse, but today millions of Americans are saying this is not who we are. But are we sure about that? What did Charlottesville reveal about America? And how can we become better? Next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app, Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street. This week I speak with Kimberly Chung, CEO and co-founder of Rumi Spice. That's a company that imports saffron and spices from Afghanistan, giving local women both a living wage and also a future. Also on today's show, barbecue evangelist Meathead Goldwyn tells me how to make perfect ribs, and we share a recipe for whipped cream biscuits and strawberries. Coming up this week on Milk Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday mornings at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sit back, relax, and travel back in time with 89.9 on Sunday nights beginning at 7 with Radio Theater.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe.
Doo-wop Revival.
Good evening, I'm Glenn Fisher, the king of the doo-woppers.
Relax Radio. Throwback Sunday. Sunday nights beginning at 7 on 89.9 WJCT. Online at WJCT.org. Looking forward to looking back.
Welcome back. Well, it was renowned as Florida's first African-American beach. Manhattan Beach, now at the site of Hanna Park here in our area, played a huge role in the growth of this city's African-American community in the early 20th century. But few people know the story. The good news is you can learn more tonight as the Beaches Museum presents a boardwalk talk with Ops Manager Brittany Cohill. It's titled Manhattan Beach, More Than a Lost Landmark. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What are your questions about the old days in Jacksonville when there were African-American beaches, Manhattan Beach and also American Beach in Amelia Island? It's 549-2937 to join us. This is called a boardwalk talk. Are you giving a talk out on a boardwalk somewhere?
No, that's the misconception. But okay. Really, it's just a catchy name. They used to be called whistle talks because we do have a lot of train history at the Beaches Museum. But we thought boardwalk talk was a more appropriate title given our proximity to the coast.
Sure. And there's a lot to talk about with this. Manhattan Beach, it's part of what is now Hanna Park, the first beach community in Florida for African Americans during the height of Jim Crow segregation.
Right.
How was it created?
Well, it was really created when Henry Flagler came to the Beaches area. He had a vision to bring the leisure class to Florida, and he saw opportunity to develop this wilderness and build this empire of railroads and hotels spanning the entire coast. He wanted to go to Cuba, didn't make it, but he did make it to the Keys. And so he employed largely African-Americans on this huge project, and that included the area of Atlantic Beach and north of that, which is where Manhattan Beach was, just north of present-day Atlantic Beach. And so when he came to the area, he brought with him the same attitudes that were common during that time of segregation and attitudes on race. And so the
profoundly racist attitudes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the hotel that he built in Atlantic Beach was the Continental Hotel, and it was a whites only resort. But the laborers, you know, needed somewhere to spend their downtime, and they spent their downtime in Manhattan Beach.
And this was really, to kind of set the tone here, this was during the height of the Gilded Age.
Correct.
Wasn't it?
Correct.
When there was this upper crust of extremely wealthy industrialists like mm-hmm. Henry Flagler.
Right.
And then the masses.
Right.
Who sort of were very much struggling.
Right.
A lot of inequality.
Correct.
So they create this beach, and then what happened?
Well, for a number of years, the area still remained very rural if you were outside the immediate reservation of the hotel. But in 1907, Manhattan Beach became a stop along the rail line that went along the coast. And so that ran from downtown Jacksonville out to the beach. And it allowed African Americans from in town to now get on the train and go to Manhattan Beach themselves. And the population was very different in downtown Jacksonville than it was at the beach. We're talking about a couple of hundred people at the beach at that time, and we're talking about more than 50,000 people, about half of which were African American.
Living in town.
In town.
And so the beach became popular?
Yes, very popular. Black church congregations, family outings, friends, they would get on the train. They could do round trip to the beach and back for 60 cents. And so it became a very popular destination.
And it became more than that over time, didn't it?
It did. It really did. I know a lot of our listeners have probably heard of Eartha White. It figured very prominently into her missions. She was able to negotiate a lot of times free transport on the train for those she served, the elderly, the children living in poverty, and she would take them on excursions to the beach. She would hold fresh air camps. Children who suffered from tuberculosis, she would take them out there for weeks to spend time in the coastal air, which at the time was thought to be a remedy for tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of rich history there and a lot of history that's unknown to a lot of people that live in this area.
Yeah, Eartha White, her daughter, the Clara White, of course, the namesake is the Clara White Mission,
correct,
which exists to this day. And it's 549-2937 to join us as we talk about the history of Manhattan Beach, these lost relics of Duval County of old. And, you know, as you talk about this, Brittany, I can't help but think about the current controversy over whether cities like Jacksonville should take down Confederate monuments and put them in museums.
Correct.
That's a raging fire of a debate right now. But there are other vestiges of this really horrific past in the South. These segregated beaches are one example. But is there? I'm not. You would know more than I would. Is there even a marker at the beach where this used to be?
There's
nothing to signify out at Hannah Park, is there?
Correct.
This used to be the center of African-American cultural life at the beaches.
Right. There's nothing there. There's nothing left and there's no marker. I am happy to say that the Beaches Museum is working to spearhead that opportunity to place a marker to commemorate Manhattan Beach. I think that's a very worthy goal and something that is very needed.
Right, because most people really don't know the history of this community in so many ways.
Right.
It's really quite fascinating. And then over the years, Manhattan Beach became less popular and people migrated up to American Beach on Amelia Island. Why did that happen?
Well, there was a number of factors. One, the railway stopped operations to the beach in 1932. So that cut off, you know, that main transportation line. But other factors contributed when wealthy investors started moving into the area and would buy up land. They would not make that available for sale for African Americans. And so in American Beach, it was much different. The Afro-American Life Insurance Company was able to buy a very large portion of coastal property up there that they could use unmolested, completely unmolested, and at their leisure. And so that was definitely a contributing factor.
Okay, and if you're just tuning in tonight, you can catch a talk at the a boardwalk talk at the Beaches Museum about Manhattan Beach, more than a lost landmark. What are your questions? The beaches, of course, were segregated in this area for many, many years. 549-2937. Tim on Amelia Island. Hey, Tim. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Love the area of Amelia Island and all the history there. I was curious about the timetable of when American Beach was developed.
The timetable, sure.
Well, American Beach came after Manhattan Beach. Manhattan Beach really existed from 1900 to the late 1930s, American Beach, I believe, I don't know the year right off the top of my head, but it was a couple of decades after the inception of Manhattan Beach.
Yeah. And so, and American Beach, by the way, can you even go up to Amelia and see any marker to, I think there is a marker for American Beach.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a little bit better known up on the island, isn't
much
it?
Much more well known, yeah.
Yeah, and so when you talk about this, the beaches were no different than any other public place in the South.
Right.
African Americans just could not go certain places.
Yeah, and as the years progressed, even if you read the charter and ordinances of Pablo Beach, which is present day Jacksonville Beach, there are laws on the books that restricted whites and blacks from using the same beach, and so blacks were not allowed to use the beachfront in Pablo Beach at that time.
What was the time frame for that?
That was in 1924.
So they would go to Manhattan Beach.
They would go to Manhattan Beach.
And when did it all start to kind of fade away? Not until the civil rights era?
I would say about in the 1930s is really when you saw its peak really start to fade.
And then the Civil Rights Act didn't come about till the 60s. So did the beaches start to integrate before that?
No. I think what we were seeing there was that they deserted Manhattan Beach in favor of American Beach.
And that's where people went for a long time.
Right.
Until the Civil Rights Act was passed.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, beaches, pools, people would be arrested. Of course, there's the infamous photo of the man at the Motor Lodge in St. Augustine pouring acid in the pool of his hotel.
Right.
Because African American kids tried to integrate the pool.
Yeah.
People would be thrown off the beach if they tried to go.
Oh, for sure. And you'll hear stories if you talk to people in the community. This Manhattan Beach, yes, it's not widely known, but it is part of the family history of a lot of our African American citizens. And so while it's not widely known to the general population, you can speak to people who say, my grandmother told me stories or my great uncle told me stories about the days of Manhattan Beach. And it's just really fascinating.
Oh, they remember going themselves as children, maybe?
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Okay, let's take a few more calls about the lost history of Manhattan Beach. It's 549-2937. Will is in Orange Park. Hey, Will, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, go ahead.
Hi, Melissa.
Hey.
Yeah, I was calling. She was talking about Manhattan Beach, but my father actually owned Evans Rendezvous down on American Beach, and there's a rich history of entertainment and history that went along with that, and I was wondering if the panelists had any comments on that.
Yeah, well, first of all, tell me about the Rendezvous.
The Rendezvous, my father actually was a restaurant bar setting where a lot of the old entertainers from the Chitlin Circus used to come and entertain.
Uh-huh.
James Brown actually was Kyle Calloway. James Brown was actually going to perform there one day, and because of the he became there. And he wasn't able to perform because the fire marshal closed the building because of the fact that it was too overcrowded.
Oh, wow.
But there was a number of entertainers, Cab Calloway, James Brown, Hank Aaron, when he used to play in Old Negro Leagues, to come there quite often. So it was a place for African-Americans to attend during the time of segregation.
And was it right on the beach?
It was right on the beach, yes. Matter of fact, there's a historical landmark today. If you go down to American Beach, you can see there's a marker telling the history of it as well.
And he had a question for you too, Brittany, I think. What did you want to ask her, Will?
Oh, my question was, did she had any information or research that she'd done about the Rendezvous on American Beach?
Oh, okay, sure. Thank you so much for that, Will. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And I would recommend for all of your listeners to read An American Beach for African Americans, written by Marsha Dean Feltz. She really covers that very rich history of American Beach, and I think that's a great place to start. There is a lot, and I do believe she mentions the rendezvous in her book.
549-2937. Renee on the West Side. Hey, Renee. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I guess I have a comment. I actually regularly go out to American Beach, and I remember my father taking me out there. I was born in 1977, and we would go out there, and there would just be a rich community. It would be a lot of people, I would say. And now when you go out there, it's just not a lot of people. There's a lot of empty houses. I guess where people have left, just abandoned the houses for, and I was always interested in trying to find out what happened. It's a sad sight now because investors are coming in, buying up the houses, and it's just kind of sad.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that.
Yeah, it is.
She's right. Yeah. When you go out there, that is what it looks like.
Yeah, and I don't think, and I think when you think about American Beach in the last few decades, it's not that they, African Americans who frequent American Beach weren't completely free from discrimination or attitudes that maybe weren't, the best attitudes towards African Americans having a large portion of the beachfront there. And so, that may be a contributing factor to the current state.
Anne is in Springfield. Go ahead, Anne.
Hi, Melissa. I just wanted to correct or to expand the information about African American beaches. Manhattan Beach is about 4 years younger than Virginia Beach in Miami. So that these beaches that accommodated African Americans throughout Florida, in the Jim Crow era, were significant places, and yes, there need to be markers to record that history. That's it. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
So tell me a little bit more about the campaign to do the marker that the Beaches Museum is leading.
It's still in its very infant stage. We are about to install a marker at the site of the Continental Hotel. And so it just makes sense to continue on that path. And while we're going to commemorate the Continental Hotel, let's go ahead and commemorate Manhattan Beach while we're at it.
Edgar along I-295. Edgar, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to make a comment that in between Manhattan Beach and American Beach, for African Americans, I'm a native of Jacksonville, there was Little Tabard Island available for blacks to attend, which was a segregated beach. And I didn't know if the historian was aware of that.
Little Tabard Island? Okay.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. Thanks. Is that
right? That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that to my attention. And I think what when we say first African American beach, what we really mean is it was a stop along the railway. It was a acknowledged African American beach with a stop along the rail. And so everyone knew, and certainly this is an acceptable term today, but everyone knew this is the colored beach, and it was advertised colored beach. And so while there were other spaces along the coast that African Americans could go to, that was largely due to the still rural, undeveloped nature of these areas. And so this was a very developed area at the time after Flagler came in, and then as other investors came in, and as we entered the 20s and 30s, this was no longer a very rural area.
This is just a preview of your talk tonight at the Historic Beaches Museum Chapel. Manhattan Beach, More Than a Lost Landmark. Free to museum members, go to beachesmuseum.org. And come on out tonight for this. Brittany Cohill, fascinating. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, performer Bridget Everett. Her raunchy comedy cabaret act showcases her wild sexual humor, her beautiful singing voice, and her six-foot-tall, plus-sized body. She's been featured on Amy Schumer's TV series and is in the new film Patty Cakes. Also actor John Cho, best known for his role in the Harold and Kumar comedies. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
So I go home and I tell my mother, and I say, Ma, I'm not going to be a doctor. I'm going to work to clean up hazardous waste. I'm going to be an engineer. My grandmother said, baby, why do you want to work on a train?
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour, true stories told live from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next episode of Hometown, handmade artisan donuts are on the menu at Jacksonville's newest donut shop, Good Dough. One of America's most notable neurosurgeons, Dr. Alfredo Quiñones, talks about his unique and inspiring life story. Recycling and refurbishing end-of-life electronics is the mission of Urban Mining. Local children with life-threatening illnesses enjoy a fun-filled event at the annual Dream Day celebration. And the historic neighborhood of Springfield celebrates Independence Day every year with a throwback baseball game that brings the whole community together. It's Hometown, Thursday night at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
Sponsored in part by Downtown Investment Authority.
Make an appointment with Public Radio's favorite family doc on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health. It'll be a jam-packed hour on healthy living, including this recipe for
Southwestern Tofu Scramble.
We always have a great time, so will you on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX.
Sundays at 5 on 89.9 WJCT.
All right, welcome back. It's the latest tale of businessman turned spy, Parker Glynn. He finds himself in the middle of an Al-Qaeda plot to try to cripple the major U.S. ports. Glynn is the only man who can stop one terrorist's secret personal vendetta against his native country and America, too. First Coast author Ron Whittington, the creator of the Parker Glynn thriller series, has a new story out. It's called Free Surface Effect, and it's on bookshelves now. Hey, good morning.
Good morning. It sounds so exciting when you say it.
Yes. Got to make it exciting. Well, congratulations. Another book out from the great Ron Whittington. How about
gosh.
That?
Oh, my gosh. Pumping out 80,000 words. It seems like it should take a day, and it takes... It's taken me 4 years for this third book to get out, just because this is the project that gets kicked down the street. Yeah, exactly.
But it's the latest in the series, so tell me about Parker Glynn.
Well, Parker Glynn, when we pick him up, he's been on hiatus. They haven't called him back, but he's called back primarily because his spy chief, his nephew, and is on a honeymoon down in Grand Turk, and they go missing. Mm-hmm. And so as part of that, he's pulled back in to go try to find out what happened to them and also to find out why one of their double agents in the same area has gone dark. And so it pulls him into another plot. And, of course, he gets to fight Al-Qaeda one more time. And
is he victorious, I hope?
Well, you have to read the book
to
find out.
You got to read the book.
But it was a fun book to write because Free Surface Effect, I know when
what's that mean, Free Surface Effect?
It's really the terminology when you perforate a hull of a ship, and it starts to list and go back and forth, just like a semi-truck. If it starts to weave, it's just that's the physics term for what happens as a boat sinks. So I heard it when I was watching a documentary on the ship in Italy that went aground and all those people got killed. And I was watching this documentary on PBS, by the way. And this guy said it, and I kept going back. It was on DVR, and I kept going back going, I love that term. It's just so cool, free surface effect. So that's how I got the title.
You never know where a good idea is going to come from, do you?
No, you don't. You really, really don't. So a lot of there's a couple of things. There's a really bad guy called Diego Delgado, who is a torturer and has worked with the drug lords in Central and South America. And so he's a pretty bad guy. And I actually picked up one of his torture scenes or what he does to a guy from Mayo Clinic, as a matter of fact.
Mayo Clinic?
When I was doing a tour there, yeah.
What did they tell you?
Well, they have a facsimile of a human being that I guess students test upon as a, you know, as a mannequin. But they were saying something to the effect that if they have to be real careful when they use pure oxygen because if the fire goes into the lungs And
I jotted that down.
Right. And it was funny. One of the guys I was, knew I was a writer. He said, "You're going to use that, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah, I'm going to use that someday."
So you come up with some real spycraft here. How do you do your research for these novels?
You know, I don't know. We are so lucky to have the internet. You think about authors back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, they must have spent tons and tons of time in the library like we did as young reporters. You know, we didn't have the internet. You had to go to the library to look everything up. So the internet's really good. But what's nice is because a lot of this is military, you can go to folks because we're a military town. So there's a lot of people you can go to to review and to interview and things like that. I worked with a naval commander that I went to church with who helped me with the initial idea, actually. She had the idea for the what I call the turn toward the end of the book, where the surprise. But she was real helpful. I met a guy who did security on cruise ships on Facebook, and so he helped me do some editing and some background on it. So yeah, you know, just people you meet in different expertise and utilize that.
Sure. And so this is the third in your series. You're building a real fan base around the region, and you're doing a whole series of book signings. Where can people come out and meet Ron Whittington?
Well, I will be at Monkey's Uncle Tavern, which hosted my very, very first book signing back in 2010. I'll be there tomorrow night from 5 to 7. I'm going to be at the American Legion Post 129, which is also in Jacks Beach, and I'm going to be giving a portion of my proceeds to their canteen construction, which they just finished, and that'll be next Friday from 4 to 6. And then I'll be down at Chamlin's Book Mine downtown during Art Walk, which is the first Wednesday of September.
So all kinds of places.
And I'll probably be more places. Also, you can order my books with no shipping cost at ronwhittington.com through midnight tonight.
So. Ooh, very nice. And before we go, you brought a little present.
Yes.
We have one free copy of Ron's latest, Free Surface Effect. If you want the latest Parker Glenn novel, email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. The unimpeachable Kevin Merchart will pick one winner at random.
Go, Kevin.
And congratulations.
Thank you. And thanks for having me on. Always good to see you.
Always good to see you, too. We'll be right back.
We know women are underrepresented as CEOs of the big companies in this economy, which is crazy when you think about it.
There's the studies out there that show that women as CEOs do tend to outperform men.
I'm Kai Rizdal, Gender Inequality as Business Disadvantage. Next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele inviting you to join us this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion from the Pasadena Convention Center with our guests Ryan Adams, Casey Musgraves, Justin Hurwitz, Mr. Kevin Nealon, also the Royal Academy of Radio Actors, Tim Russell, Serena Brooke, and sound effects man Fred Newman, of course. Ms. Aoife O'Donovan will be there. My Song of the Week and much, much more, all right here.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. Knowing your evacuation zone is critical for your safety in a weather emergency. Visit a public library to get your 2017 Hurricane Preparedness Guide. Stay informed with real-time updates at jaxready.com or download the Jax Ready app to also identify your specific zone and important information. Keep your radio on 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
This segment is brought to you by GuideWell Insurance Agency, exclusively serving members of Florida Blue.
Welcome back. Finally this hour, it's an easy way, maybe, to win $1,000. Yeah, the Jacksonville Historical Society's $1,000 photo contest is live now, but a deadline is looming. If you want to get in on this, you need to move fast. Historian and author Wayne Wood is here to tell us about it. Hey, good morning, Wayne.
Good morning, Melissa. This is exciting.
Yeah, and so what is this all about?
Well, the Jacksonville Historical Society is designed and has been founded since the 1920s to accumulate and perpetuate Jacksonville's history, and our archives has tens of thousands of photos. We recently got a grant from William Jeter and Deanna Clark to try to get contemporary photos that show everyday Jacksonville life, architecture, events, people. And so we have a contest, and it's $1,000 for the first prize. And there are also second prizes of $500, third prize of $300, and two honorable mentions for $100. So that's $2,000, and all you've got to do is just send us your photos. And the deadline is next Tuesday, so you better hurry up. It's open to amateurs as well as professional photographers, children who can take high-resolution photos on their camera. It's open to anybody.
Anybody.
And it's free. There's no cost to enter. So this is one of those great deals.
What are the criteria? What does the picture have to show?
Well, it needs to show everyday life in Jacksonville, and it needs to be taken within the last year. And so it could be a birthday party. I saw a friend's picture the other day on Facebook of pushing her child in a swing. It was an adorable picture, and so that's part of Jacksonville's life. It could be buildings. It could be events. Anything that depicts life and culture in Duval County is eligible to win.
And
you can submit up to four photographs, and there are three ways to submit them. You can deliver them in person to the Jacksonville Historical Society, and you can also upload them on the Jacksonville Historical Society website, or you can mail them. But because Tuesday is the deadline, maybe you should deliver them in person or upload them. And the Jacksonville Historical Society website is www.jaxhistory.org, J-A-X-history.org.
Jaxhistory.org. Now, the winner gets the $1,000 bragging rights. Will their photo be displayed anywhere?
Part of our goal in this is to do a historical display of many of the photographs that are entered. So in the early part of next year, we will have a display of all these photographs, announce the grand prize winners, and it'll be something that will not only bring fame to those who submit their photos, but it'll be a delightful way of seeing everyone across the county's pictures of mm-hmm. our daily life.
Is this the first time the society's done this?
This is the first time we've ever done this, but hopefully it will become a tradition because, you know, so many images of Jacksonville get lost. So many events don't get captured. The Jacksonville Historical Society archives is so extensive, and most of our photos, frankly, are from a long time ago. And this is our new movement to capture everyday life as we go along so that 100 years from now, people can look back at these photos and see our historic photos from today.
I'm going to take photos inside Publix when I go home today and submit them because that will capture my little slice of Jacksonville life. I'm just kidding. I wish I could think of something more interesting. You know, next Tuesday, we may all go up on the roof of WJCT to watch the eclipse. Maybe I'll take a few pictures of that and Monday.
The eclipse is on Monday, and the deadline for the contest is on Tuesday, so
yes.
You theoretically could do that.
Theoretically.
As an eye doctor, I caution everyone in Jacksonville to be sure to wear your approved ISO safety glasses if you look at the eclipse. We will only have a partial eclipse here in Jacksonville, but if you look at the sun, you must wear glasses. Do not look at the sun without those.
You're going up to the Carolinas for the total eclipse, aren't you?
Luckily, my brother has a house that is 700 yards from the exact line of totality, so if the weather permits and we don't have clouds, we will get to see the full spectacle of Mother Nature's greatest event, the total solar eclipse. And most people don't realize, but it suddenly goes totally dark. The wind picks up. The temperature drops. You get a 360-degree sunset. The animals come out at night. And it's just for this brief 2 minutes and 40 seconds. And you can actually take off your glasses when the total eclipse occurs during that 2 minute, 40-second period. But do not do that in Jacksonville. Do not look at the sun unless you have approved glasses.
Do not do that, but do take your pictures and do submit them to jaxhistory.org for the Jacksonville Historical Society's $1,000 photo contest. Capture a slice of local life, win $1,000. The deadline is Tuesday. So Make sure to mark your calendar for that. Wayne Wood, you're always cooking up something amazing. Thanks for sharing this with us, and have fun at the eclipse, the big eclipse party.
Thank you, Melissa. It's going to be fun, and I appreciate being on your show.
That is our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen to us there anytime. Next on 1A, America is doing some soul searching. What will it find? That discussion's coming up. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.